Saint Teresa of Avila said something that I have always enjoyed and keep close to my heart. Teresa was a mystic of the 16th century, 16th, 17th century. And to quote her, she said, "From silly devotions and sour-faced saints, gracious God, deliver us. From silly devotions and sour-faced saints, gracious God, deliver us." Those words come to mind because of the two readings with which, especially at this Mass, we are dealing with. And I would like to begin on my way to the woman at the well. I would like to begin with the image of Jesus driving the money changers out of the temple. You see, one of the things you have to understand, and you begin to see this very clearly when you study religion, I have made it my business to not only study Christianity, but to study what it is in the human character that drives us to try to establish some sort of a relationship with beings called God or gods. And I'm not going to get into it super deep, but let it suffice to say that from the beginning of our recorded history, human beings have always felt captive to the mercy of the forces of the universe. Most early peoples did not understand. They had no scientific methods. And so they understood the forces of the universe as being managed by super beings, which they called gods. And these gods were, of course, very much projections of people's minds and their fears. And they always would try to figure out how could they get the gods to look upon them favorably so that the gods would not be mad at them and send them negative things like famines or floods or pestilence or wars or enemies. And so what they would do is they established what normally you and I would do when you wanted to curry favor with somebody. And that is, you would give them gifts. And the gifts were supposed to sort of be a kind of a barter situation where, you know, when somebody gives you a gift and you like it, then you kind of feel well disposed to that person and you feel to some degree obligated to really be nice to them. And so in the ancient world, people would do that. They imagined these gods who were in charge of the rain, the thunder, the sun, the moon, the weather, water, and they had different deities for things. And what you did was you tried to figure out how to worship this god by gift giving. That's the ancient source of sacrifices. You sacrificed to the gods, and it was sort of a bartering system. You know, we give you a good sacrifice, you treat us well. And it was considered It was, they were not, please understand, these people were not open-minded at all. The sacrifices had to be made in a specific order. And if the gods did not respond well, that meant that you had made a mistake in the way you offered them the sacrifice. And so the sacrificer might become the sacrificee. This kind of almost bartering system of trying to influence God and gods, because remember, the word God is a perfectly empty, I always like to tell people that the word God is kind of like a box. The question is, the word God has been used way before Jesus and way before even the Jews. But it's a content, it's a box, basically. The issue is who's inside the box. Or is the box empty? If you're an atheist, you're saying the box is empty. If you're an agnostic, you say, I don't know who's in the box. Okay, and if you're a Christian, then what you're saying is the word God, we believe, contains the God of Jesus Christ. But let me not get too far ahead. As religion developed in the ancient world, sacrifices were offered to all kinds of gods. And at the beginning, the Jews began their relationship with God, and God allowed them to use animals as a substitute, actually, for human beings. Because in the ancient world, and not so much in the ancient world even today, and even in recent history, we see human sacrifice being performed. Because people thought that the greatest gift that they would give to one of the gods would be their oldest son, or one of their daughters, or something like that. And so the way that Jewish worship began, it began very much like the copying of the worship of other pagan people. And God slowly and over time, because you always remember, God saves people, both the history of humanity and also in your own life. He saves us over time and in layers. It's not all done like that. It's progressive. You slowly advance. For example, in the Bible, if you begin reading in the Old Testament, you look at Leviticus and you look at Exodus, and you have very meticulous instructions as to how to kill an animal and offer the sacrifice and sprinkle the blood and eat the meat. And so you have this tradition of animal sacrifice even in the Bible. But then when you start turning pages in the Bible, and you turn pages, and as you're turning pages, centuries are going by, okay? And you get into the prophets. Then you have prophets, Jeremiah, Isaiah, Hosea, prophets later in Israel's history saying, thus says the Lord, who the heck asked you for these stupid sacrifices? They do not please me. They stink. You know, why? All the animals of the world are mine. I don't need you to be offering me dead animals. Thus says the Lord. And then when you are sitting there going, whoa, wait a minute, God, didn't you just say back here to do it? Yes. But the problem was you misinterpreted it. Because as the Bible was being written, God was teaching his people over time and in layers that he did not require sacrifice. That the sacrifice he wanted was an obedient heart. A person, not the body of an animal, a person who was willing to give obedience of themselves in relationship with God. That's why, you know, in Isaiah, I think it says, rend your hearts, not your garments. Because in the ancient world, there was a very popular devotion of whenever you wanted to do penance, you would take your cloak and you would go, and then you would sit in dust and ashes and put ashes over yourself as a sign of penance. So by the time Jesus enters into the picture, this is still the practice in Judaism. This is the practice all over the Roman world, all over the European world. And not only that, look at our own continent and look at the background, for example, of how the Aztecs and the Mayans, the Incas, how they related to God. Human sacrifice was regular in our own continent. So when you really look around this, this is not just a European custom of somewhere in the ancient medieval world or ancient world. This is a universal understanding that these sacrifices. Now, I'm going to teach you a 50-cent word that you can use to impress your friends. Okay? You ready? The sacrifices were apotropaic. Apotropaic. You know what that means? Apo means away, and tropos means to turn. So whenever you offered God a sacrifice, it was apotropaic. Why? Because what it did is it tried to turn away the anger of the God, and what you wanted to do was please the gods. Now when Jesus came, Jerusalem and the temple in Jerusalem was offering all kinds of sacrifices. You would be amazed if you were back in the second century what going to church would be like. Going to church was a very bloody business. Okay? When the priest in the temple would sacrifice blood, sometimes people say that blood was reaching up to the ankles. There were so many animals being sacrificed and then given to the people and blood being sprinkled and stuff. It was messy. It was really messy. And so what would happen was, where would you get all these animals? Well, in the ancient world, and especially in the Jewish world, what they did is they had a kind of a convenience store. And this was outside the temple, right in one of the courts of the temple. You didn't have to come from a village like 10 miles or 20 miles away, dragging a goat to sacrifice, or a lamb, or some doves. But what you would do is you would get there, and you could buy the animals right there. And then you could go ahead and sacrifice and do your worship. It was convenient for people. And this is when Jesus walks in. And this is what you have in the gospel in the B cycle. Jesus, remember, he's not, please understand this, he's not mad because somebody is selling holy cards in the narthex. Okay? He's not worried about that. Sometimes we extend it to, if you sell, you know, holy cards back there, somebody ought to come in with a whip and get everybody out. And that's not what Jesus was saying. What Jesus was saying is he was rejecting the whole understanding that God had to be approached by making a deal with him, by offering him stuff, so that religion had turned, instead of a relationship with a loving father, religion had turned into a sort of a bartering system. You gave to God, and then God gave to you. And exactly how much did God require for my forgiveness of my sin? And instead of being the relationship of person to person, a relationship of love, a relationship of trust. The whole religion had turned into bartering. Had you kept this law, you kept this, you did that, and God gave you that. And it was burdensome because you were always worried about making God angry. And you were always worried about not doing things perfectly. And the problem is that that kind of attitude in religion hasn't gone away. It hasn't gone away. I still meet Catholics who are very paranoid about, did I do the sign of the cross exactly correctly? Or did I do it correct? Did I go, when I went to confession, did I mention everything? And it's almost, and you still get this attitude, that this idea that somehow God has a particular ritual, and that if you don't do it exactly right, he's going to be mad at you. And that was what was operative at that moment. And so Jesus, understanding that he has come to restore and to initiate a unique relationship between us and a Father who loves us. A Father who, yes, we can relate to and we can offer gifts, but we don't have to be paranoid. We do this and we do good things, not because if we don't do them, he gets mad, but because whenever you love somebody and they love you, you do wonderful things for each other and you enjoy it. And that's why Teresa would say, from silly devotions and sour-faced saints, gracious God, deliver us. Because what it's about to be, was supposed to be, was the problem was that the relationship was no longer the relationship of people who loved each other, a God who loved us and people who loved you. It had turned into almost, prostitutional, in the sense of pay and mercy. And you love me and I pay you. And so when Jesus sees this, he's not reacting just to the people selling. He's reacting to the whole temple. He's reacting to the fact that he is angry that people have turned the God of Israel's approach to his people. And they have allowed it to degenerate into a quid pro quo. I give to you, you give to me, we barter. And he says, get it out of here. Get it out. Because that's not who God is. And so what you find in this situation is Jesus pushing away the whole notion of what religion had turned into. Now, focus now on Jesus coming up to the well. And notice the dialogue between Jesus and the woman. The woman is also caught in this. Jews don't talk to Samaritans. No. We don't. As a matter of fact, in the gospel, it says Jews don't even use anything that a Samaritan has touched. Now notice the rigid demarcation of you're bad people and we're good people and all of this. And we got to do everything just right. And then the woman's not only Jews don't touch anything that Samaritans touch, but not only that, they don't speak to women. And they don't speak not only to women, but Samaritans. And you weren't even supposed to acknowledge them as human. They were just out there. And all of a sudden, Jesus comes, and notice how in his dialogue with the woman, there's not even a hint of all the different blocks, of all the different artificial divisions. He comes and he says, give me a drink. She's shocked. And that's when he begins to introduce her to a concept that she doesn't get. And that is using the imagery of water. A lot of times what happens to us Catholics is that we don't get the metaphor. The metaphor Jesus is using here is the metaphor of thirst and water. And the woman thinks that when he says, I'll give you living water so that you won't be thirsty. Oh, give me this so I don't have to come back to the well. Jesus isn't talking about that. He's using a metaphor. And what's the metaphor? That the relationship that he has come to introduce humanity to is a relationship that will so transform your life that you will feel the emptiness inside of you under the metaphor of thirst. You will feel the emptiness inside you filled. That your life will begin to experience, as he said, a well of spring water. That your life will begin to be filled with purpose, with peace, with a sense of, ah, this is what it's about. That's why Jesus would say, come to me, all of you who find life burdensome. Come to me, all of you who are weary, and I will give you rest. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light. That's the whole point. As soon as you begin to understand that, and begin to understand the temptation, and it is a temptation of making your faith burdensome, you begin to understand the same thing, the same temptation that had driven these people into thinking that they had to please God in a quid pro quo in order for God to love them. That temptation is still very present among us. Very present among us. And it's a temptation. Pope Francis, I'm an admirer of Pope Francis. I was reading a couple of the things that he said, and he was talking about to people who train priests. And he was talking about training them as loving human beings. And he went on to say, otherwise, when we ordain them, sometimes they can turn into little monsters. That's Pope Francis talking about clergy. Okay? They could turn into little monsters. Can you imagine that? And why? What's that whole point that he's making? He's making the point the temptation towards taking religion and twisting it into something that it shouldn't be, taking Christianity and twisting it into what he used to say to Pharisees, you Pharisees, you build up burdens onto people's shoulders and you make them carry it and you don't lift a finger to help them. That's what's going on today. And so what I want you to see is the opposition between this gospel, in which Jesus is rejecting that whole quid pro quo, you know, you do this and you follow this regulation and that regulation, and he is going to the woman and he said, if you knew who was telling you this, he would give you living water. He would give you living water. And he just sweeps away all of those things. And so as we're going through, you know, Lent, please remember, check yourself out. Because a lot of times, without knowing it, we can begin to practice our faith as if it were a different version of that, where you have a quid pro quo. That's not what our faith is. Our faith is about our Father, a Jesus who is willing to say, I don't care what you do to me. I don't care what you do to me. behind me and up there. I don't care what you do to me. I will always forgive you. I will always. Pope Francis this morning, I read, he said, we may exaggerate the forgiveness of God, but it's true. The exaggeration is true. There is no limit to God's forgiveness. There is no limit to His mercy. None. You can do that to Him. Don't you think that would have been enough to provoke a God at anger? And yet, what comes out of Him? Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. That's our faith.